Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Fritz Busemaker, CIONet partner and founder of top global leadership organizations throughout the world. Fritz, thank you for coming in today, I should say, and sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
Hi, Stephen. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for having me.
Fritz, you have this just an incredible background of leadership and success in so many different areas. Can you overview some of your past roles and societal contributions and how you succeeded in each role?
Yeah, sure. I think the common theme is for the last 25 years, I've always been working in the ICT industry internationally, always responsible for marketing and alliance roles with a focus on business process management. And over those years, worked for various international organizations, but it was always about bringing people together, organizations and ideas. And for the last couple of years, that's been a full-time focus, as I currently am indeed partner of CIONet and manage a community to bring Dutch parliamentarians together and have them give an insight on what information technology can do for society. And especially to mention, I'm also on the steering commission of IFIP's WCC conference, which will take place in September this year. And come back to your question on what I think you could say success. At the end of the day, it's a people's business, I've found out. So being very open and honest as you can, give what you have, let people share what you have to offer, and really maintain your network of contacts, I think that's the key to success, realizing you're dealing with people at the end of the day. So that, I think, sums up what I think is the significant success factors.
Now, Fritz, again, looking over your background, you've done so much. So can you give me some three shareable lessons from each of your major roles?
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the key lesson is actually look what you have in common when you meet other people. In my experience, I've seen in the past a lot of people who look at unique value propositions, what sets them apart. So you're looking actually at how you differ from the other person. Which is not, I'd say, a good basis to have a good sharing of ideas and concepts. So looking what you have in common, I think, is for me the key lesson. Secondly, give to get is just as important. I see a current society where it's actually of value if you share what you have in common. And that also means showing real interest in the people you meet. So really take time to listen to these people. And in some cases, what I've noticed that if you meet somebody, they tell them what their issues are. You actually remember them and do a little bit of homework. Well, hey, I recommend you or suggest you contact that person because he might have a solution for you or an idea. Most of the time, people are pleasantly surprised and will actually thank you for that. That thanks makes be expressed on the same day. And maybe you'll be thanked in 10, 15 years later. And I've actually had that experience. And that also is another lesson which I've learned. I think it's the third lesson, is I would say that time is the new currency of, you could say, today's world. So realize what we need to do, what we want to do takes time.
I also get this impression that you're an amazing connector. Can you talk more about that?
I think some people would qualify me as a pathological connector almost. So almost accusing me of having a big network. And to be honest, I've never realized that until other people may be aware of that. And I think it's a matter of showing real interest in people. I think remembering people, remembering faces. And I think everybody has that experience when you meet somebody you haven't spoken to for some time and you forget their names. And I see sometimes people shy away from that person. And if you're just honest about it, say, well, hey, sorry, I forgot your name, then actually people will, they'll be kind to you. And after that, you can say they'll definitely remember you, and you will remember them. And it's... And so over the years, you tend to know a lot of people because I feel that we all have the opportunity to meet all those people, but I have seen people who tend to forget people and more look at the individuals as a function representing something rather than the person behind the function. And if you do the latter, you actually are able to create a big network and get people connected. So it's a mindset, I would say.
Now, earlier we talked about the fact that you're a partner within CIONet. Can you share some of the history behind this amazing organization?
Yeah, it was founded in Belgium in 2005, the time when communities like LinkedIn were being set up. And the two people who set that up realized that the CIOs, the chief information officers, would value a community where they would be able to get connected and bring them together both online and offline. So they set it up in 2005. A small year later, we set that up in the Netherlands as well. And that model, more or less like a franchise structure, has been rolled out throughout Europe. So we're now in over 10 European countries. We've just signed Portugal last week. And so we bring together around 3,500 CIOs and IT leaders, making it the biggest online-offline community of its kind in Europe and probably even in the world. And by using the franchise structure and having local, say, CIONet entities in each country, you actually take into account the local culture, the local language, which is quite significant because people want to get connected not only on a European level but also on a local level to take that into account. So it's been quite successful. I think we're definitely going to hit over 4,000, maybe hit even 5,000 CIOs becoming a member this year, and it's becoming quite a success at the moment. Very proud of that.
You know, I'm looking at this little idea of tremendous growth that you've exhibited in CIONet, and what springs to mind then is, what are the goals of CIONet for 2012 and beyond?
At the moment, it's sharing best practices, sharing information. The tagline for CIONet is "What's next?" So what we do is we have a very strong focus on providing content which people expect to get. So there's some hot topics at the moment which people want to have information on. But it's also about bringing topics on the table which they might not expect, but you want to just bring them to the next level. So not only talk about the topics of today, but also talk about the issues which will be an issue next year or in 2 years' time. And that is actually, let's say, the focus for the community as a community. But the other goal is realizing that as a community, we are also of interest, and it's interest to connect this community to another community, so to other groups. So develop those external relationships, for instance, with the European Commission, with the members of the European Parliament or the local parliaments, or the CFO community for that matter. So linking the CIO community with the communities which they have to link with as well. Facilitate that infrastructure so the members can be successful within the community, but also they are successful in connecting that community to the outside world, as it were.
So from a funding standpoint, is there a membership fee?
No, there's no membership fee. The membership fee is paid by a number of business partners. So we have over 70 business partners who fund this. And that model works quite well. I've noticed that CIOs, when you talk to them about that, actually are very open and eager and willing to be on the same community with business partners, provided those business partners bring content as well. So what we see is that we have either the senior executives or a CTO or a CIO of a business partner or the CEO being a member, because they either provide knowledge and vision on particular technology issues or new methodologies, because that's in a lot of cases where it's being developed, or they bring their network of contacts and best practices as well. So the funding is done by business partners and very well accepted. So it has an open character. So we don't isolate the CIOs bring them together, but we allow them to connect with, you could say, that audience, which is being well appreciated at the moment.
Now, earlier in my introduction, I indicated you're a partner with CIONet, but let's drill down further to, you know, see what that means. So what is your roles with CIONet, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have two roles within CIONet. For the Netherlands, I'm one of the three partners with primarily responsible for engagement. And that means that I'm responsible for organizing the relevant events to happen, the relevant contacts people want to have. So, for instance, we had a CIO from a major bank who was interested in talking to other organizations about their outsourcing experience. So through CIONet, we're able to provide them with contacts with a number of people who have the same experience. So that's one thing, engagement for members and events. But I also am the liaison for the European Commission on behalf of the whole CIONet Europe. I mean, Brussels, from where I live, is just a small hour away. And that's where the Commission gets together. And I must say the Commission is very focused on information technology. I'm proud that somebody, the Commissioner Nelly Kroes, the Commissioner for the Digital Agenda, is Dutch. And we actually have the opportunity to meet her every now and then. And they have over 70 MEPs, members of parliament, who actually have a focus on information technology. So by providing that user community and getting those people together, we actually provide benefit for the commission who wants to tap into what's happening on the coalface. We get an opportunity to share what are CIO issues to the people who actually make policy. So it's it works well for both sides. And if you, so what I try to accomplish there is actually so with the help of our advisory board, which actually consists of about in each country 15 to 20 CIOs, identify those issues we need to address, need to discuss, need to explore, and increase the common knowledge. So you can almost see it as a guild where we bring experts together. And of course, also on a local level, connecting the CIO community to other communities. Good example, in a couple of months' time, we'll be sitting down with the CIO of the Dutch government and his staff and see how the CIOs of the Dutch government can share experience with the CIOs of, you could say, industry, and it's well rewarded.
Earlier, you were involved with the WCIT, and can you talk a little bit about that past involvement?
Sure. First of all, let me explain what the WCC is about, the World Computer Conference. Now, that is the flagship conference of the IFIP, the International Federation for Information Processing, and that is set up, endorsed by UNESCO, I believe, in 1959 in Paris. And it's a biannual conference. It's going to be organized now for its 22nd time in Amsterdam. And I sit on the steering committee. And that conference aims to bring the global IT professionals, practitioners, academics together. And what I actually bring to the table in the steering committee is my experience with similar conferences. Like, for instance, 2 years ago, I was the program director of the WCIT conference, which is a conference, the flagship conference of the WITSA, which actually brings together all the major IT suppliers together. But with that experience in organizing international events and the experience with CIONet, I actually want to bring the CIO perspective to the table to make certain that we bring the questions they have to the international community of IT experts, which will aim to bring together, you could say, September this year. And by bringing those people together, I'm realizing these people are experts. I'm much more focused on organizing dialogues, roundtable sessions, rather than monologues. So make certain that we tap into that community of experts, tap into that brain power, so not just hear some great stories, but actually create value by being together that week. So that's my generic, you could say, contribution. So it's talking about the way we share and present that knowledge. And I have a very specific focus on e-skills, make certain that we put e-skills on the agenda as well.
Fritz, you mentioned e-skills, so let's segue into that. What are your desired outcomes from e-skills?
Good question. E-skills is seen in the light that our profession, information technology, arguably is only 40, 50 years old, so it's still a young industry. And what I see is we need to create some awareness that we should start to think about e-skills on all levels, and not just the professional level, people who actually do the programming, but also e-skills on the leadership level, so people on a policy level who need to decide on issues which in a lot of cases really involve something related to information technology, and also on the user level. So create that awareness that it's becoming a part of our daily life. I've actually observed that 10, 15 years ago, you were probably talking about football in a normal social environment. I just realized, and I'm assuming I'm not biased given my background, but I've noticed in the last couple of years, also if I talk to my neighbors, if I talk to my mother, if I talk in a normal social, non-business related environment, people implicitly talk about the need for e-skills. They talk about their iPad. They talk about getting on the cloud. They're talking about social media. So they're talking about it. So we need to really make people understand that you need these skills. And when you're talking about, when you start to think about that, I think it's also very valid to have a common language, some taxonomy, a common understanding. So we are going to talk about things from the same page. Not only should we talk about skills, we also talk about the framework. And that's also what, for instance, the European Commission is doing, is developing a European e-competence framework. Now, this is very specific for the practitioner, but to make certain that when we talk about somebody's skills, they all have the same meaning in the various parts of the world. Information technology, the way it's being done at the moment, is a global industry, so you need to have, say, global standards, and they're not there yet. So if we can come to an awareness that this should be done on a global level, I'd be very, very happy.
And I guess you're tying into the European Commission e-skills framework.
Yes, the European Commission, sorry, I should mention that. The European Commission has set up its e-competence framework, and I'm actually part of the group to discuss the ECF. And they are eager to develop the e-competence framework, but also have the competence framework checked on a global level. So last March I was in Brussels talking about the development of the ECF, and they mentioned that they'd be interested to actually test and assess its value on a global level and bring people from Japan, Australia, the States to discuss it end this year. So it will be an ideal opportunity to actually have that discussion, bring it forward, and have that end September, because then we're going to have all these practitioners and experts together anyway. And I just had an email from the guy responsible for the whole e-skills and ECF program from the commission, who reacted very positive. And so we're now seeing if we can actually put that in the agenda, the whole ECF discussion.
I guess it reminds me that, you have this ECF discussion and the European Commission being involved, but I know that probably you don't want to reinvent the wheel either. In other words, that there's other initiatives around the world. Let's see if we can share some of those.
I think it's a matter of awareness. I think all these initiatives, if I look who's involved, they are so focused on, you could say, the content, and so eager to create something, so I definitely want to position this as something positive, that they sometimes forget to look what's happening outside, what's happening on the other side of the ocean, on the other side of the world. So I think it's a matter of not just having the awareness sometimes that to reach out to other good initiatives. Connecting the ECF to the other global initiatives, I found out, actually got a very favorable reply from the people responsible that, yeah, we just basically were not aware of what's out there and my assumption, we were just too busy doing what we set out to do. So I think not being an ECF or an East Coast expert possibly gives me that opportunity to take that outside perspective. I say, well, hey, hold on, let's be a little bit lazier and let's see if we can actually look what's already available. Let's look at the common ground, as it were. And that's at least my assessment why it's not been done so far. Basically, people have their heads down and start to work.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I'm aware of the IFIP, which is the International Federation for Information Processing, but they have this initiative called the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, or IP3. Mm-hmm. But they've done a mapping exercises of the different competency frameworks around the world and have compared them, have looked at them. So some of that research should probably be of value. Or recently I attended a summit in Los Angeles hosted by the IEEECS, but it was for an organization called FEPL, the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations. And at a prior board meeting, the U.S. government did a presentation about their work, and they even have a wiki where they've put in considerable resources developing a competency framework, and they wanted to talk to the governments around the world and say, hey, let's share some of this work so that, you know, we're not, you know, redoing efforts and we can work in unison. So it'd be interesting to connect these different sort of programs around the world.
I think I'm all for it. And I think it's a matter of sometimes bumping into individuals from the different communities who can then link those two very big communities to each other. Because I mean, my statement was a bit black and white, but if you probably sense that somebody's done this before, but then where are you going to ask the question? Who are you going to call? I mean, if you don't have the right context or knowledge how it works, you cannot just call the European Commission and say, well, can you put me in contact with the person responsible for it? That's quite a difficult task. So you sometimes just need those individual connections to make it happen and then bring the two big organizations together. So making that connection September this year, I think, is an excellent idea, and let's make that happen.
Yes, exactly, or even the considerable investment of the Canadian government in something called OSPM and in the IT community, and that work has gone back about 20 years now, but it's fairly detailed and fairly complete, so it'd be interesting to share some of that data. Now, you talk about September, and I guess we're, again, talking about the World Computing Congress 2012, which is an IFIP event, which you talked about earlier. So who should attend the WCC 2012 and why?
Well, if you realize that the IFIP represents all those national associations, you're looking at a small 1 million people who are then directly or indirectly linked to IFIP. Now, hopefully, we would be able to get just 1% of that crowd coming to Amsterdam. That would be great. Probably not realistic, but any member of IFIP or an IFIP association interested in dialogue with their peers from a global background should attend. But also any individual or organization who wants to learn, talk, or meet with the global IT professional community should come. So it's not just the IFIP crowd, it's also those other organizations which, like the European Commission or the Canadian government or the American government or the Australian government or those associations. Let's have that discussion and let's not have the people be the reason why you should attend, or that you could say the poster boys, but the discussions themselves, and realize that everybody can learn and share if you bring those people together. It's all for anybody. It's open for anybody interested in, say, information technology as a true profession.
Sounds like a great opportunity for people from business and industry and governments and academia and other organizations throughout the world to get involved and, as you indicated, to learn and share and connect with each other.
That's what we're hoping to achieve. Get a significant crowd in Amsterdam, which in itself is a great city to visit, so that in itself should be an excuse to come anyway.
That's true. Now, you talk about throughout this interview this idea of sort of connecting and working together, and so let's talk about that in more detail. Can you explain this shift to connect and collaborate?
I got this from a good friend of mine, to be honest, a guy called Peter Fingar, who is quite a guru on business process management. I've written some great books on that. It's the shift from a command and control to a connect and collaborate society. And I've been looking at that for the last couple of years and realizing that more and more over the last couple of years, we are organizing value at the moment by bringing people together. And I had this experience that a former colleague of mine came into the room of his 14-year-old daughter. I'm talking about two, 3 years ago. And he was quite mad at her because he assumed she was not doing his homework. And his vision, what he saw was the computer was on, the music was on, she was on the phone. And then he realized that my perception, my image of homework was sitting in your room alone, closing the curtains, closing the door, and doing your homework as an individual. And what you see at the moment is that this new generation, this Generation Y, or this Generation Z, as some call it, are actually using today's technology, like social media, like mobility, to allow easy connection, allow, let's say, cooperation, to create value. And I mean, and that's also what I do. I mean, I've never realized that because of the internet, I actually now order a book in my local bookstore called Amazon, or I never done that, but I like the idea of developing your own t-shirt on Threadless, something which the internet has allowed us to do. So shop on a global level, and so we're connecting and collaborating with colleagues, with our friends at high school, and on a global level. The internet just doesn't have a barrier in that sense. So that's where I see it heading at the moment.
I guess this idea, I see this in this book called Digital Cowboys from Pekka Veli Kenyon, which was quite popular. You know, I get business models, the community, everything is changing because of this connect and collaborate that you're talking about.
Yes, it has various names, but it's definitely changing at the moment. And I think one of the things that people should realize also that this is quite an issue for the baby boomers. So it also, I think one of the things which, because we're always talking about the technological side, we tend to forget the soft skills. We tend to forget what it takes to make it happen. And I realize there are cultural differences. So in one country, some countries you achieve it a little bit different than others. But if I look at what are the criteria of success, for instance, a leader, in the current system, in a command and control system, it's being king of your empire. It's being, to control people and budget. And if you ask them, hey, what do you want to do, next year? It's always more people, more money. But when you are in this connect and collaborate environment, that no longer applies. And you see this younger generation looking for something else than, let's say, grow in the hierarchy. So it's actually the people, the baby boomers, who've grown up in that hierarchy for the last 20, 30 years, who are still in a leadership position today, they have to realize that the success criteria, our values, will be changing. And I don't know if you've ever read the book Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Corey Dettorff, who identified the term Woofy. And Woofy is actually, you could call that social capital. It's a combination of your actions and your visibility. And Sarah Hunt once written a book, quite a serious book on that, that the today's economy is about the woofy factor. It's about, you could say, your social capital for success. And something else we also should realize is that we all talk about this command and control, this hierarchical model with an organogram, which Frederick Taylor gave us when he wrote in the book The Scientific Organization, that that's the way we organize organizations. And in 1972, if I'm correct, Ronald Coors, somebody from the UK, got a Nobel Prize for economy for his whole idea of the transaction cost. And basically, he gave us the scientific proof that an organization exists because the cost to produce something within the organization is lower inside than outside. I tell you what, with information technology and the internet, all of a sudden you see that the transaction costs outside some organizations is so much lower than inside that the base reason why organizations exist is disappearing at the moment. So a lot of these organizations are losing their reason for existence because of what information technology is bringing us at the moment. So we have to talk about a new type of leadership, but realizing that managing a network requires different skills than managing a hierarchy.
And I had this discussion with Kishore Swaminathan, who's the Global Director of Research and Chief Scientist for Accenture, and he's founded, I guess, their technology labs around the world. But he talked about the fact that, you know, I guess corporate boundaries, even geographical governmental boundaries, are disappearing. They're all porous, and how, again, that's going to change everything that's happening worldwide. So it kind of speaks to your connect and collaborate rather than, the shift, I guess, towards connect and collaborate.
It's you all of a sudden see clients becoming the R&D department of an organization. So you've outsourced your traditional R&D to your client base. So that's a shift in the business model as well. And I think I understand it's quite a successful company.
Now, so what does this mean for required leadership?
I think I'm still trying to find and identify what it needs. My current ideas, it's much more about facilitating connections. So I'm not predicting or advocating anarchy. We still need people to, you could say, set the scene, give us direction on where we need to go to. But leaders should realize that with the current technology, they should expect and anticipate dialogue. So realize that it's about listening to what's happening out there and tap in on that collective knowledge and brain power and aggregate all that information for suggestions. So a leader should much more listen to what's out there, because people will be able to have a direct connection with that leader, him or her, and to his following. I mean, that's actually what Twitter does at the moment. So that's those would be my current first ideas, and it's a tough one to crack, because our state of mind has always been to be in this command and control mindset, and I realize we need to change it, how to change it, and to what. I think that's for us all to discover over the next couple of years and see what works.
How is the perfect storm an enabler?
The perfect storm is a phrase in the IT industry coined by the analyst Forrester. They said, well, we got a number of disruptive technologies like social media, mobile, cloud, smart systems being the Internet of Things. And in itself, these technologies are disrupting. But just like the film of George Clooney, The Perfect Storm, where these four waves actually come together and converge, you see that it's actually the combination of social media, mobile, cloud, and some smart systems which create this, business-changing scenario, which is going to be very disruptive. The way we organize or can organize value is going to be so much different. That's tearing a lot of organizations apart at the moment. We are creating completely new business models in this world because we have these technologies. And so I underline the fact that these technologies are indeed creating a perfect storm, and the way we've done business with the use of IT in the past is going to change.
And this increasing penetration of the Internet, you know, there's over 2 billion users of the Internet, or smartphones are now on par, I guess, in sales as with typical mobile phones. So, you know, just everything is changing.
It's changing, and I hear too many stories around me from people I trust who realize something's happening, and I think in a couple of years' time, when we look back at this period, I think it's quite a transition we're in at the moment, and we're not even realizing it at the moment.
Why is it important to connect different worlds to each other?
My experience is that when you organize a community, when you bring people together, in a lot of cases, you're not realizing that you're actually in a glass silo. And what I mean is, you're not, the walls are transparent. You're not aware that in a lot of cases, it's preaching to the converted. You are talking to your peers about issues. So opening up your community to other communities, actually, in a lot of cases, it's, first of all, it's a reality check. You can actually, your beliefs you have, you can assess how valid they are. And it's actually the outside world which are allowed to ask the stupid questions, because if you are part of that community, you're not expected, or nobody actually dares to ask those very basic, simple questions anymore. Also, it allows you to spread the word a little bit more. And actually, there's quite a good book by Franz Johansson called The Medici Effect, which talks about the Medici model of the Italian Renaissance as a model that by bringing all these various groups of people together, you can actually organize innovation and creativity. And you could almost say it's organizing serendipity. So it has value. You don't know what's going to happen, but you know something good will happen.
What are your best practices for connecting worlds?
As I said before, it's about look what people and organizations have in common. And sometimes you really have to find and search for that. It's not always that obvious. But if you make an effort, even on a personal level, if you see two people having something in common, they actually start to really be open and listen to each other. And sometimes it takes a little bit of practice because you have to realize that each group, culture, organizations has their own norms and values, languages, and they're different. So the speed we do things are different from one community to the other. So if you look at the differences, you give up quite easily and say, well, hey, I'm not interested. But if you realize that, let's say, you can almost say you take off your own shoes and then before you can step in the shoes of another. And then with this open mind, look what you have in common. You can actually organize some great value out there if you realize that you might have a common goal.
I guess it's sort of a related question then. What are the best practices for alliance management?
I could almost give you the same answers, to be honest. But with alliances, I think that's also where my pedigree is. There is no hierarchy. You have different roles in alliances. So my background is software alliances, consultancy alliance, and you have different roles, and therefore also different objectives on an individual level. But if you identify the common objective in that value chain and determine, say, some collaborative key performance indicators, then you could create some very good, great alliances. And the thing there is, and that's my experience over all these years, is that a lot of organizations do look for piggyback rides. They do look for all the nice work projects and benefits from the other side and forget what they have to bring to the table. So there has to be that balance from both sides. And that respect Wolfie applies as well. It is about the right people facilitating those relationships. Alliances can be quite complex, multi-level alliances on both relationships. So you have to have that Wolfie factor. And you can also look, if you want, to the Chinese concept of what's called Guanqi. And Wolfie, that's been around for a small 10 years now, since Cory Doctorow wrote his book, or 15 years even. But Guanqi has been around for at least 5,000-6,000 years, and it's the Chinese terms, the basic dynamic in personalized networks of influence, which is actually a central idea in Chinese society. And again, that's a good example of applying the Medici effect and connecting to different communities and seeing what we could learn from a Chinese concept, Guanqi, and take that into the Western world, and just looking at Guanqi alone. So that alliances is communicating with that other partner and listening.
We're now going to shift directions in this interview with this next question, in that we're going to talk about some of your other expertise. And in this question, I'm going to ask you, what are your best practices for business process management?
Okay. Well, I founded the BPM Forum 2002. At the time, I was marketing alliance manager with Stauffer. Nobody knew who Stauffer was. And I realized, because we were the only European company in the Gartner's Magic Leader Quadrant on BPM, I realized we had the right answer, but nobody was asking the question on what BPM was. So the BPM forum was actually set up as a neutral platform to raise the question of what is business process management and what can it offer. And I've noticed by discussing that and putting it on the agenda, first of all, also in that case, we needed a very clear definition of what BPM is, and it's also a definition which keeps on changing over the years. I mean, it was a very technological-driven, straight-through-processing definition around 2005. All of a sudden, it's becoming a management discipline. And I'm a bit concerned that we push the envelope of the BPM definition a little bit too much, that you cannot distinguish business process management from anything else if everything is BPM. What I've also noticed is if you ask people, I've run a number of workshops and given keynotes around the globe, and I ask the audience, can you please give me, what is your emotion when you hear the word process? And you would find a lot of people actually give quite a negative emotion. So there's not a positive connotation with the word process. So if you are part of, let's say, the BPM glass silo, and you have understood the benefits of BPM, but then all of a sudden you want to talk about BPM with the outside world, we have to be aware that the outside world may have a different emotion, a different mindset when we talk about BPM. And that's something we need to address first of all before we can actually have a discussion on the content. And finally, I think the last lesson is practice what you preach. It's very important to not only talk about business process management, but also demonstrate it by putting it into practice and putting it into action, not only for yourself, but also to the people you want to deal with. Because if you make people part of that process, of any process, and you allow them to learn, the information sticks. You're changing people's mindset.
Rich, you have a considerable history of success, including in many, many domains, and you've contributed to several books. Can you share then some of your experiences or shareable lessons from your books?
A couple of lessons, because I think that in summary, it all comes down to the same thing. If it's either alliance management, business process management, or community building, for me, they're all, I'd say, ends of the same stick. They only have a different wrapper, because it's all about bringing people, organizations, systems together, see how you can get them to cooperate. And always, basically, if you're talking about alliance management, business process management, or even community building, it's looking how you can create value for a customer. And for me, the business process, the alliance, they're all the same thing to offer, you could say, a value, create a value in a team effort for a customer. So they might appear to be different, but there's quite a big overlap when you take the wrapper away and you look at the content.
Yeah, earlier we talked about IFIP, and this International Federation for Information Processing, which was founded in 1960, though it had their first Congress, World Congress, in 1959 under the auspices of UNESCO. Now, talking about 2012 and 2013, what do you see as the biggest opportunities or challenges for IFIP going forward?
Well, what I like is this personal feeling that IT is... itself is becoming a trending topic. It's something we talk about in our social life. So the fact that it's on the agenda, I think, is the big opportunity. And that's also where the big challenge is, because I realize that information technology is a real profession. Create those big complex systems takes a lot of skills to make it happen. But with the current, amplification of technology, we have an issue that it looks just a little bit too easy. If you get 14-year-old school kids building applications, putting them in the Apple Store and actually get them downloaded, you do get the CEO of companies going to their CIO and asking, well, hey, why can't you do that within a day? And not realizing the security and the privacy issues and the standard issues. So I think a role for the IFIP represents representing the ICT professional is make certain that with the current attention to information technology, from a user perspective, we have to be aware it's a real profession which needs real skills. So that would be the biggest challenge for the IFIT to get that ready.
I'm now going to switch to yourself in terms of all of your current roles. What are your biggest challenges and their solutions?
One word, I think ego. We talked about the shift from a command and control to a connect and collaborate society. I see that happening. There are lots of people who see that happening around me. But that shift in mindset does something to the ego. As mentioned, current leaders, people in the top of a lot of organizations today, they have a mindset based on controlling that, you could say, hierarchical big organization. And it reminds me a little bit of old smoking ads. If you go on the internet and if you type in old smoking ads, you actually get on the very first page already babies telling in the advert, "Oh, mommy, what does your cigarette smell nice?" Or doctors claiming that 80% of the doctors prefer this brand of cigarette because that's the healthy and cool brand smoke. And we currently know, and we've known that for the last 30 years, that smoking causes lung cancer. And it's only recently I've seen, at least in this part of the world, people changing their behavior and their mindset towards smoking. Now you're an outcast if you smoke indoors. You're actually sent outside. Go smoke out in the rain. So the lesson there from that metaphor for me is, although the technology, the perfect storm, allows us to implement all the solutions today, I believe it's going to take at least a generation comparable to smoking.
Fritz, can you now describe or discuss your predictions for the future business trends and their implications and opportunities?
Sure, yeah, Stephen. Well, I think the perfect storm, as we discussed, is going to be a trend for some time to come. And with that fact, also the whole idea of bring your own device is something I see becoming quite an issue in the CIO agenda, having to do with all these tablets and smartphones. Something actually as a sideline, gamification as a way to actually interact with the user is becoming quite important as well, which I predict. So using game strategies to deal with users of the system, I think is something which will come up more and more. But what that means is actually the implication is that I see more and more now the business taking the lead. So for the first time you see a CEO walking into the room of the CIO and actually asking, "Well, hey, I got an iPad here. Why can't I run my company from this iPad?" Demanding that systems will be presented as he or she would like it. Just last week, we had an event with CIONet at Heineken, the brewery, who talked about the fact that budgets for their e-business strategy are not part of the IT department, but actually part of a department which is very difficult to place and actually report directly to the local CEO, because it's neither marketing, it's neither IT. So the IT budget, the IT spend, not just being managed by the CIO and his department, but also by other departments using that technology. And that also means I see new roles develop. I think information technology is becoming so complex. I think there are very few individuals out there which can be a true CIO and do all the roles. So I see a role, the role split in a lot of cases, where you would have, I'd say, an upgrade of the CTO, more and more responsible for enabling the right infrastructure to be implemented, and a CPO role, or Chief Process Officer, who is actually taking care of the business side. And we have to realize that, so with this business drive towards the use of information technology, I think we have to be careful about the number of concerns the current CIO has about security and privacy issues and how to deal with that massive amount of big data of teradata and petadata coming into an organization, which somebody has to handle. So the positive side is we see it as the enabling technology for a lot of business. The negative side is how we're going to handle all this.
The next question is about computing as a profession. You know, we have engineering and accounting, medicine, law, and many, many other sort of acknowledged professions. So what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, recognized credentials of some sort, and how do you see this building out?
Well, first of all, I think ICT is a combination, as a profession, a combination of a craft, a science, and an art. So it's quite difficult to talk about BPM as a profession. It has all these complex aspects to it. But it also reminds me a little bit about an article from Nicholas Carr, who wrote the great book IT Doesn't Matter. And in, I believe, 2005, he written an article, The End of a Corporate Computer, where I actually made a comparison between how we are currently developing IT systems and how we develop electricity and producing plants 100 years ago. And the article mentions that over 100 years ago, everybody had their own local power plant, so no standards, no economy of scale. And he said, well, the single biggest invention for the last 50 years, information technology, we see exactly the same thing happening all over again. All these proprietary systems with their proprietary skills and standards. So there's no or very limited economy of scale, which is a real issue at the moment. So that we need some kind of professional standard to allow that economy of scale and that effectiveness to take place. And the same, and if you then you could say continue the analogy on the electricity power stations. I mentioned the European Commission is looking at developing a e-competence framework. And we're also now looking at, mapping the industry-based competence, training and competencies and how we could map that on the ECF. And, that's why we map the local, power plants, for our national grid, make sure that everybody has the same, filters to use. But I believe what we need to do, for e-skills is, really need to give them the same sets of rules as we give, our doctors and engineers. Because there are a number of surveys out there which really predict a very big shortage of qualified professionals out there, which we really need to make it happen. So there is a need for e-skills development and a need for a standard, so we can also all develop our e-skills in the same format.
So you're seeing really this whole idea of a shortage, as you indicated, in qualified professionals in the ICT space, and there needs to be some kind of common framework to help address this skills shortage in the marketplace.
It should create a much more effective, efficient situation if we use the same skills so we can share resources to do what we need to do. And if we all have these proprietary resources, then it's going to be quite difficult to transfer knowledge. And I was sitting last year with Commissioner Nelly Kroes, with somebody who is responsible as CIO for one of the big telco companies, who really complained about the fact that she could not compare the resumes from one individual from one country to another country. Completely different skill set because there was no standard. So she had already difficulty last year in getting the right staff on board because didn't have a standard. So for me, that was a great awareness that it's already an issue today, which we need to tackle.
Right, and I guess then we are at an inflection point in history that this is a great time to have computing as a recognized profession, where you have common standards and it eases mobility as a result. Now, here's another question, and this is going to mine your deep insights in the CIO and CTO and leadership community. And it's about your candid thoughts on emerging technologies and really the CIO position versus the CTO position. So what are your comments on the CTO and CIO positions versus, or I should say about technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiencies?
Okay. As I've like I said, the CTO, I think, is more and more becoming there's going to be an upgrade of that function, becoming more and more important, responsible for the infrastructure. And so that's also why I see the increase, I would say the evolutionary increase in efficiencies coming from. You could always relate to Moore's Law predicting the doubling of chip performance every 18 months. So what a CTO is increased efficiency, offering that increased efficiency with the increased efficiency, which you could say the technology, both the hardware and software side, is actually offering. The CIO, which could become a business-focused CPO, Chief Process Officer, could have a completely different role to play because using the right technology, they could actually be able to create and provide completely new business models. So I think they are the people who are going to lead the blue ocean strategies for organizations and present completely different things an organization could do using that technology. So CTO is much more, I would say, in the evolution space, increased efficiencies, therefore also increased revenue growth. The CIO, in a black and white scenario, could be offering completely different business models to an organization and create new organizations because of that.
Now let's take this same sort of question, that is providing your deep insight and your candid thoughts on emerging technologies and taking the position of CIO versus CTO. And let's extend that to this next question, and that is the impact of business driving technology decisions.
Let's see. It's actually, I think, the recent developments of the tablets, the smartphones, the application of information technology, which is driving a lot of the stuff here. It's in Dutch Parliament. I think it's the very first parliament in the world where all the senators actually get an iPad and all the information is on an iPad delivered to them. And that ease of use generates questions in a boardroom, in that environment. And we all know that, say, a stupid man can ask more questions than 10 wise men can answer. And so in that same analogy, I think we're going to see, because now all of a sudden we have that technology available everywhere, people starting to become creative and question, hey, can't we do this like this or do that or like that? So it's very much going to, I believe, change the decisions over the technology, same like Heineken does with its e-business strategy. It's the young, it's actually the guy who gave the talk, he was 36 years old, and he told me and he told the audience, he actually felt he was quite old because the new, fresh, and young ideas how to apply the technology are actually from his 24-year-old, fresh out of high school colleagues. And so there's a lot going to happen there. So it's the business and society users which are driving technology decisions at the moment. It has stepped out of the ivory tower. You all have something to say about it.
Again, let's extend that prior two parts of this question, that is your thoughts on emerging technologies, the CIO versus the CTO, on this concept of technology perspectives from the customer's point of view.
Well, I always feel that you should always have the customer in mind first and last, because if there's no customer at the end of the day, why actually do you want to deliver something? Why actually provide a product or a service? So for me, the customer is what I would call the gravity of an organization. It's actually the thing which pulls an organization into its optimal shape. And so it's almost like a force of law, how a customer perceives something. And given the fact that customers are more and more vocal and can share their insights and ideas about the product or service with the glow at the moment, I think we really have to pay attention to those customers.
Again, related to the series of questions on your candid thoughts on emerging technologies, CIO versus CTO, do you think CIOs are becoming the chief innovation officer together with being the chief process officer?
Probably some other chief ex-officers will want to make the same claim, but I think a lot of organizations, not all, the innovation is based on information technology. So that, because that's the enabler for a lot of organizations, how they change their business models, it actually comes down to the chief, the CIO, to actually provide those innovative ideas and search on a global level those ideas he or she could bring to his own organization. So yes, because a lot of these organizations are completely IT enabled, it's actually the CIO who could actually be the source of the innovative ideas and facilitate that, make it happen. And also the perfect storm allows has shown that actually those new business models and innovation can be developed there.
And in this discussion that we've been talking about CIO versus CTO, what are some other hot topics on their agenda?
The couple of with the whole application and gamification, the fact that we're getting all these big data and the fact that we want to have it on any device and bring your own. I think that's, I'd say, the hardware, the technology push side, which is almost unstoppable at the moment. And then there are the issues about the security and the privacy, especially if we move all these systems into a cloud environment. So there's quite a big concern there that we may not always be aware of the risks involved when we collect so much data, which is difficult to maintain and has to be maintained not just on the standard device, but on any device possible. And having said that, realizing that we need to, we can think about what's needed, what can be done, but somebody has to execute this. So we have to really realize that in the near future, we're going to have a shortage of e-skills and professional workers who understand information technology. So if we don't start to invest in developing the right e-skills, we can have all these great ideas and all these hot topics, but we don't have enough people to actually execute them. So that has to be something on the table as well.
Fritz, in this next question, we have five parts, and in these five parts, I want you to share your deep insights on each of these parts, and that is about or concerning governance and board insights, and your candid thoughts on what boards are really thinking. So the first part of the five parts is the board's top three concerns as it relates to the integration of technology and business.
I think I can reiterate what I've said. It's managing the different sources based on bring your own, the big data collected, what am I going to do about the cloud, and will I have enough people with the right skills to make it all happen? Those, I think, are the real issues at the moment.
The second part of the question then is, again, your candid thoughts on what boards are really thinking on. You know, who do boards rely on within the organization?
That's a tough one. To be honest, I'm not too certain about that. I think traditionally it is a CIO, and it should be a CIO, although I see a number of CIOs struggling with the questions they get, because I suspect that there are even a number of board members out there who actually refer to their teenage son or nephew who has done something, which is showing something quite sexy on his nice iPad, and gets them to think. So that means that I think board members, and that's also a trend I see, I realized, actually looking for some young people to inspire them. Like beginning this year, we had a 14-year-old application developer coming in and explain to an audience how he developed an app and why he did that, and that for an audience of top 700 IT professionals in the Netherlands. And that was one of the people, just 14 years old, inspiring, you could say, the baby boomers today, realizing, hey, this is the personification of our future, that these guys know what's going to happen. So it's our younger generation, generally.
What are boards thinking about in terms of deploying an IT governance program?
The fact that you have all these young people who don't see the limits, don't see the boundaries. I think there is a concern there, which they do have, is probably it's not the CTO role there, not only providing the technology, but also providing a good governance model that you could say what we're going to develop is not going to bite us at the end. So we need a good set of definitions, good governance practices, how we're going to manage this new society.
Do you think that boards should be involved in things like ITIL or COBIT or other kind of frameworks that could be used?
Not necessarily that. I think they should not have in-depth knowledge on the highest board level that exists, but they should understand that these are questions which their CTO, CIO department needs to address. So they need to realize that the information technology systems is not just about the system, it's also about the information in the system, which is, I say, tenfold amount of more valuable than the system itself. So the governance practices, they should understand that somebody needs to be made responsible for those various standards you've just mentioned.
You know, with the increased reliance on IT and, you know, there's these different governance models that can be employed, how does that kind of perspective get onto the board itself? I mean, if the CEO is attending the board meeting, should that CEO bring in the CIO?
Yes, but in some cases, still in a lot of cases, the CIO reports to the CFO and not to the CIO. So yes, the CEO should bring in the technology into the board meeting. In a number of cases, you see that already happening, but there's still a lot of companies out there where the CIO is not a part of that board meeting.
And then from a broader board standpoint, do you think that board should invite independent directors to have a great technology background? For example, your background, I think you'd be great on board.
Okay. Well, not applying yet, but I'm happy to at least make. I think one of the things people need is being aware of the impact and the significance information technology has for organizations and societies in general. So educate yourself is something which needs, and that's the leadership level of e-skills which we need to focus on.
Okay, so what are boards thinking about in terms of innovation and its impact on the organization's future success?
I think what they realize that if they do nothing, they may not exist in the near future any moment. So I think a lot of boards are thinking about how to tap into the current value chains, how to tap in that younger community. You see banks setting up give an example. You see Dutch banks becoming a telco provider because if you're a telco provider, you actually have control of, you could say, the customer because he uses his mobile phone much more than he uses a bank nowadays. But you see telco providers, for instance, in Africa who actually are becoming a bank where mobile payment is being used to actually literally pay for a couple of gallons of drinking water. So what you see is they use the technology to innovate their business model and being something they were not a couple of years ago.
And the final part of this five-part question on what boards are thinking, and this part is on what should boards do about preparing the workforce for the future, or how should they be involved in that?
First of all, they should educate themselves and realizing that information technology is a very significant fundament of almost any organization at the moment. So realize that they need to invest in getting the right IT professionals on board to develop the systems, also having the right level of digital literacy almost. So we have to become IT literate to also use the system. There's quite an interesting report which came out a couple of weeks ago by on behalf of the Dutch government, which claimed that we're losing 19 billion a year because of not only poor IT systems, but also lack of skills using those systems. So if we actually can educate people on all levels, and that means policy level, user level, and professional level, then we can start to prepare for that part of the future. And I also want to refer to something which I experienced in my role. It's running ePort, the Community for the Dutch Parliamenticians. In the Netherlands, it's still quite difficult, to be honest, to identify a member of parliament. who has a focus on information technology. And I want to compliment the European Commission, because this is an organization called European Internet Foundation, who actually has over 70 MEPs which are a member. And the governance board is run by the member of parliament themselves. So it's very much looking how information technology is driving innovation and prosperity in Europe, and also realizing it's not a European or American or first world issue. It's also a global issue. I'm in contact with an organization called FIAfrica, which is a local initiative who are helping third world countries, specifically in Africa, building up their IT skills, because they realize that if you provide those skills, you can actually increase the economy. And I'm actually quite proud that 2 years ago, as program director of the WCIT conference in Amsterdam, I was helping selecting the people, the person who was who should win the Challenge of Change Award. And we've handed that out to Mrs. Elizabeth Mukasa from Uganda, who won that report for how she actually brings user information technology to in school projects in her country to allow for inclusion of Uganda, connecting that to the world. So it's a great example on a global level how people are getting connected, being part of the global economy through information technology.
Perhaps Elizabeth would be a candidate for a Nobel Peace Prize.
She'd be over the moon. She's it's really great what she's done, and there are lots of people out there, and bringing those examples to every now and then to what we're doing really puts what we're doing in perspective.
Fritz, that's a great story, and I guess it comes to mind that maybe you have some other great stories you can share, maybe something amusing or surprising, unexpected, or amazing from all of the travels that you've done.
Well, I got 25 years worth of stories, so it's difficult to select how much time you have, but I've mentioned a couple of things in the interview, which I've realized came back to also some examples that I was a keynote speaker at a BPM conference in Melbourne, Australia, talking about business process management. And because of a number of reasons, one of the other speakers wasn't able to make it. So they asked me, hey, we got a whole slot available. Can you do another presentation? And I didn't have another presentation, but I had some ideas, some 10 lessons learned on community building. And at the spot, you could say they'll share those 10 lessons on community building and just realize that business process management and community building are exactly the same thing. So looking at what they had in common, took that experience with me, and a friend of mine who is a professor in alliance management in one of the local universities, moved from one university to another university. I happened to be just a couple of yards down the hall from another person I know who is a professor on business process management. So they didn't know each other, got them together, and they realized, I realized that they were looking at the differences, because they could phone me up, so well, very nice, but I don't see alliance management and BPM having anything in common, which I found quite strange. But, and also what I see when it comes to this pervasiveness, I am proud that I just realized that. 2 years ago, when the iPad came out, we had Dom Segola, one of the co-creators of Twitter, coming to the conference, and Dom and I got to know each other quite well, so I asked him, hey, could you actually bring me an iPad, because it wasn't available at the time. And you know, Dom, he took an iPad with him, so quite a neat thing. So, well, you know what, my mother, she was also about complaining that she wasn't on the Internet. She didn't know what she was missing. So I gave the iPad, rather than keeping it myself, I gave the iPad to my mother, and I was really amazed that 2-3 months later, she came to my house with a USB stick and said, well, hey, I got some good music and books on this USB stick. Can you put it on my iPad? And never in my mind I could have imagined half a year ago before that that she would ever actually be able to ask a question. It just proves that even if you're 75 years old, you can use that technology. And some other stories out there. This one finally maybe, which I think explains something else we should focus on. It's about communication. It's about, you could say, setting standards. It's about realizing we need to talk the same language. And I used to work for a company called Logica a couple of years ago, and one of my colleagues, the director, Ben Bennett at the time, English, wanted to learn Dutch, and we were in a meeting with Shell, and in the elevator with the elevator full of show professionals actually came up to the guy we were going to meet, and he asked him, may I have a relationship with you? Completely not realizing what he asked, because I think it was his 10th Dutch lesson. He was practicing his Dutch, which was good, but he didn't realize what question he was asking. And he made an even bigger faux pas in the meeting itself, because we were in the meeting, and at a certain point, he was starting to call the guy at the other side of the table Mr. Neat, or Neat. And it was a great interview. And after the interview, the guy said, well, okay, you got the job. I'm happy to take you on. But can you please explain me why you're calling me Neat? Well, I'm just assuming that's your first name, because you got this sign in the front of your desk which says Neat Storen. And he just made the wrong assumption, because Neat Storen is just Dutch for do not disturb. So there was some lessons on communication there to be learned. Very funny.
That's a good story. Fritz, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables. And can you, sort of like in this interview, you know, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Steve, do you have any kids?
Yes, I have a daughter.
Okay. I was just wondering, I just realized that my youngest daughter turned 8 today, and I just realized that the question I would like to ask her is, as a parent, would you, I mean, most people, when I was their age, what do you want to grow up? I want to be a fireman, I want to be a doctor. I was just wondering, will we grow up in a situation where we will ask our kids, well, do you actually want to be an IT professional when you grow up? And actually, I hope the answer is going to be yes, but just wondering if we're going to ask that question to our children.
And that's a great question, and especially because if you have daughters, there's a shortage of diversity in the IT field as well. So.
Yeah, I think that's the only question I have at this stage. Just can we make this a true profession which people really want to go into, realizing we're not just users, we also need people to make it happen. And that takes some selling as well to do.
Fritz, you have this considerable history, significant global and historical contributions in so many areas and so many domains, and again, significant global leadership. So we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulating deep insights with our audience.
Thank you for the interview, and it was my pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Fritz Busmacher, CIO Net Partner, founding top global leader.